While this trend line provides a frightening visual of our reality, the more terrible truth is that over 8,000 people who were beloved members of their families are not coming back, and their deaths are an incalculable loss to their friends and their family, as well as our community.
LA Public Health Director Barbara Ferrer fighting back tears at yesterday's coronavirus briefing. Death rates in Los Angeles County and across the country continue to break records. More than 3,000 Americans died yesterday. That's more than died on 9/11, more that died in the attack on Pearl Harbor. The country is pinning its hopes on vaccines that are arriving within days. The FDA could approve the use of the Pfizer vaccine today. And if that happens, California's frontline healthcare workers could begin getting the shots this weekend. Soumya Karlamangla is a health reporter at the Los Angeles Times, and she's here to tell us more about the vaccination plan in California. Hi.
Hi, Madeline. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, who exactly are the frontline healthcare workers who would get the first doses?
So it's going to be targeted at hospital workers, and specifically hospital workers who have contact with COVID patients. So their jobs put them at most risk of getting COVID. So those are probably ICU physicians, nurses, people who, you know, it's pretty obvious that they're just the most open to exposure.
And I understand there are about, 327,000 doses in the first shipment that could arrive this weekend, as soon as this weekend. So is that only 327,000 people?
Yes. That's the first, the vaccine, this Pfizer vaccine is two shots. And so that's the first shot of the Pfizer vaccine for 327,000 people.
In the entire state?
In the entire state. Yeah, it's a really small slice, but this is the first shipment, and you know, those will start to pick up and grow throughout the rest of the year. So it's not, you know, this is not our entire allotment for the month of December.
I see. Well, how many doses are needed for all of these frontline healthcare workers?
The number that we usually have for healthcare workers in the state overall is 2.4 million, but that includes people who are not working in hospitals. That's just also includes your neighborhood family physician. So the goal is that the first round is going to include all healthcare workers, and that includes people who are working in nursing homes and also nursing home residents. So throughout the month of December, we're going to get a mix. We're going to, that first 327,000 will be just hospital workers. But by the end of December, we're supposed to get about 2 million first doses. And so those will be mixed between those different groups. So we'll start getting out of the just healthcare worker space, but you know, 2 million is not going to cover all the healthcare workers. It's not going to cover all the nursing home residents. So this is just really the very beginning.
I see. All right. So beyond those two groups being vaccinated first, then what's next in the early months of 2021?
So that's actually still up for debate. And yesterday there was a meeting of the state advisory committee about vaccine distribution. And there were a bunch of comments from different lobbyist groups asking that their, you know, in their industry that they represent be next in line. And so there were people saying that it should be farm workers, it should be teachers. There were people advocating for journalists, you know, just all sorts of different groups. So we actually don't know which group will be next.
Who would make that decision? Is it the local public health department?
So the decision would come down from the state. Then I think if the local governments wanted to do it a little bit differently, they could, but it's most likely going to be a state decision.
So what about, I think many people listening to this are wondering, what about me? If I'm not an essential worker, if I'm not a healthcare worker, when do I get my shot?
Yes, this is my question also. So it sort of depends how many vaccines end up being approved. You know, the approval we're talking about today is for the Pfizer vaccine, but we expect that the Moderna vaccine will probably also be approved next week, so a week from today. And there is a number of more vaccines coming down the pipeline. So it's all kind of in flux, but the experts we talked to said anything from spring till fall of 2021. And so it looks like the sort of worst case scenario is that we would kind of have people, most people vaccinated and get that desired herd immunity by the end of 2021.
Wow, spring to fall. So people making vacation plans now Should they cancel them? Should they not do that?
Well, I think it probably depends where you're going on vacation. I think that it's a little bit riskier if you're flying. Flying is a high risk activity. If you are trying to go to another country, because, you know, this is what's happening here, but who knows what the situation will be in whatever country you're planning to fly to. We interviewed an expert yesterday who said, you know, if you're going to plan a wedding for summer of 2021, make sure it's all refundable.
Oh, boy. Well, why would it take that long to distribute the vaccines widely?
It's just a matter of production. We never make this many vaccines at once. The number of flu shots that we make every year is far less than the number of coronavirus vaccines that we need. And then it's, you know, these early vaccines that are up for approval are two-dose vaccines. So that's actually double the amount of vaccine production. And then it's also just a giant logistical issue with trying to get the vaccines to the states and then from the, you know, the county health department or the hospital that's administering, getting the vaccine into people's arms is a whole nother challenge. The vaccines, these first two, Moderna and Pfizer, require extremely cold conditions for storage. They need to be shipped in sub-zero freezers across the country. It's just, you know, it's a huge undertaking. No one's ever done anything like this before. And yeah, it's just going to take a while to get them made, to get them moved, and to finally get them into the people who need them.
And is there any concern that people who are vaccinated could still carry the virus with them and transmit it to people who are unvaccinated?
Yeah, it's sort of an unanswered question at the moment. So the fear is that after you get the vaccine, you may be infectious with the vaccine. You won't have any symptoms, but you'll sort of have the ability to give the virus to someone else. And we just don't know. But what experts are saying right now is that given that we don't know, and there are just a lot of unknowns here, and, you know, in the next couple of months, the next 6 months, we won't know who on the street is vaccinated or not, and who's between their two doses of the vaccine, and when immunity exactly takes effect. So we're going to have to stick to the social, you know, masking in public and some of the social distancing, just because, you know, it's all new and we're not sure how it's all going to play out.
So we don't know yet, like, once you get the shot, what point you become immune to coronavirus? Like, would it take days or weeks?
The original clinical trials found you get two shots. The second one is administered 3 weeks after the first one. And then I think it's in a week or two after the second dose that they found that you get your 95% efficacy that they found in the trials. However, this week, the FDA did an analysis of the data and they released a report saying that it seems as though you actually get some sort of good amount of immunity after just the first dose. So as you can see, it's just changing. And as we vaccinate more people, we will sort of understand that better, probably.
So ultimately, by this time next year, we should be back in a fairly normal situation. That's what experts are telling you?
Yes. And there are some experts who are much more hopeful. You know, like we had an interview a while ago with an expert who said, like, Easter, you know, things will be different of 2021. So, yeah, but definitely by this time next year, things should be looking pretty different.
All right. Let's hope so. Salmia Karlamangla, healthcare reporter at the Los Angeles Times. Thank you.
Of course.
Well, a few months ago, Governor Gavin Newsom signed a law that requires county health officers in California to track how the pandemic is affecting the LGBTQ community. It's not really being enforced, though. And if that data is collected, well, it's spotty and inconsistent. LGBTQ advocates say their community is vulnerable to underlying health problems that could be exacerbated by COVID, such as HIV. And that prompted the bill's author, State Senator Scott Wiener, to send a letter to the California Department of Public Health this week, asking officials to do a better job of collecting this data and to do that right away. And State Senator Scott Wiener joins me now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us more about this bill and why it's important.
Sure. It's pretty basic. If you look at what we've learned about COVID since earlier this year, about the outrageous death rate among Black people, the outrageous infection rate in the Latinx community, the differences on impacts of on older people versus younger people, the only reason we know that so that we can take action to address it is that we collect data on the race, on the age, et cetera, of people who are getting tested for COVID, who are being hospitalized for COVID, who are dying from COVID. It's incredibly important data. We are not collecting that data for the LGBTQ community because when people sign up for a test or go in the hospital and we ask about their race, their gender, their age, we're not asking them about their sexual orientation and gender identity. And that's all this bill requires. It requires healthcare providers or counties or the state to simply ask the question. People don't have to answer it, just like they don't have to answer about their race, but it gives people the option and you start collecting data so that you know how a community is being impacted and you can take steps to address any health disparities with that community. So we should have been collecting this all along. We weren't. So we passed legislation this year to mandate it. The governor signed it and it went into effect immediately in September. We're now in December and it's being sporadically enforced at best. I've gotten tested for COVID several times this fall and have never been asked about my sexual orientation. I know people in L.A., Sacramento, same thing.
Yeah, I've never been asked and I've been tested. But why? Why isn't this data being collected if it's the law?
You know, I've learned in the as a legislator over the years that getting your legislation signed into law is only the first step. You have to make sure that the agency that is responsible is actually enforcing it. And it appears that the California Department of Public Health is not enforcing this law. The CDPH, the Public Health Department, needs to be, you know, talking to providers and counties and making clear that this is legally required. That does not appear to be happening. So we need some, you know, implementation and enforcement of this law now.
I mean, to be fair, it is crazy crisis time right now with the pandemic. I mean, there's unprecedented levels of infection and mortality these days. Is it feasible that this has really been put on the back burner while public health officials deal with the house that's on fire?
Well, the fact that the house is on fire, that we have this surge, is all the more reason to make sure we're collecting data about a community that we know has increased risks in terms of the types of jobs that LGBTQ people perform, in terms of higher rates of cancer and homelessness and smoking and so forth. And so we need that data. And of course, we know that our health authorities are drinking water from a fire hose. I'm not expecting perfection. I'm not expecting that it should have happened the day after the governor signed the bill. But we're now almost 3 months later. And to be clear, this issue was flagged back in May. They've now had 7 months to get going with this so that we can actually protect this community. And they appear to have done very, very little. So it's just completely unacceptable.
So once they have the data, then what? If they do find out that there are increased risks with the LGBTQ community, that either they're getting infected more or dying more of this disease, then what?
Well, when you look at what we've learned about older people being more vulnerable or people in communities of color being more vulnerable, we've taken steps in terms of resource allocation, in terms of focusing, whether it's testing or other things, we focus those resources to address those disparities or, you know, in terms of how we administer the vaccine. But if you don't have the data, you can't even make those decisions about resources, focus, educational campaigns.
And how hard would it be to collect this data? Is it just a simple question on a form?
It's not hard at all. And in fact, the state has already changed its database to include questions about sexual orientation and gender identity. But unfortunately, it looks like at least many of the counties and healthcare providers have not changed their intake forms. This is about intake forms. We're all familiar with this. When you sign up for a COVID test or when you go to your dentist or go into any healthcare setting, you're asked, what is your age? What is your race? What is your gender? All it requires is two additional questions about gender identity and sexual orientation. It's not rocket science.
California State Senator Scott Wiener from San Francisco, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
coming up, why Democrats and Republicans are united in wanting to break up Facebook and why it won't be easy. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
The American public deserves a competitive, vibrant personal social networking market, and we are taking this action to restore the competitive vigor necessary to foster innovation and consumer choice.
That's Ian Connor, director of the Bureau of Competition at the Federal Trade Commission, announcing yesterday that Facebook is too big. The FTC, along with more than 40 states, are suing to force Facebook to break up. California is part of that lawsuit. In it, they argue that Facebook has stifled competition by buying up its competitors. They want the company to sell off WhatsApp and Instagram. Here to talk about all this is Mike Isaac. He's tech correspondent for the New York Times. Welcome back, Mike.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, it appears bipartisanship is not dead. Democrats and Republicans are united in wanting Facebook to be smaller. So tell us a little bit more about what their argument is in this lawsuit.
Yeah, so, over the past, I would say, 4 years, really since the 2016 election, I think there's been a growing consensus around tech's power, big tech power, and specifically Facebook and this sort of what lawmakers at least would call stranglehold on social media the company has in the United States. And, you know, for a while, I would say it was more of a Democratic interest to think about big tech power. You know, historically, Republicans want to leave businesses alone and sort of let them flourish and provide the free market solutions to it. But I think the thing that's changed over the past few years is Republicans are starting to increasingly believe, or at least say, that they fear the types of speech being allowed on networks like Facebook or companies like Facebook that own other platforms like Instagram and WhatsApp. They're worried about one big company having too much control over how people communicate. And I think that, you know, Democrats and Republicans can at least agree, even if not about the specifically speech concerns, that too much power in the hands of one giant entity is something to be worried about. And so after years of sort of building a case, interviewing hundreds of people, they finally brought it to a crescendo of calling for Facebook to break up.
Right. And so it's the federal government plus the states. Are they joined together or are these a bunch of different lawsuits?
Sure. So there are two separate lawsuits. The FTC is filed one, as well as the separate one by the 48 attorneys general, 46 states plus two territories. And so it's sort of separate but concurrent tracks. And really, I see it as like a strong showing of force, kind of noticing or kind of like underscoring the idea that it's not just one or two states. It's a very broad-based effort across political lines.
And they are proposing specific remedies. They want Facebook to divest itself of Instagram and WhatsApp, right? That's their core argument. But the problem with that is they approved it, right? I mean, the FTC approved those deals during the Obama administration. So how can they argue, those aren't good deals after all?
So this is a really good contention among some legal scholars. So Facebook is making the argument that you approved the transaction years ago. Now you want what they're calling a do-over. And this is all just sort of revisionist history to go back and say, actually, we don't want it. But some vocal proponents of the breakup are actually saying that the mergers were not approved at the time, but rather that the government decided not to bring a challenge to the case, which is an important legal distinction, because at the time they felt that the evidence was not sufficient enough to bring a challenge to the acquisition. But as time goes on, new evidence sort of comes to light, and they still reserve the right to revisit those older cases, even if they didn't challenge them at the time. So I think that's important. I think that's going to come up during this course of the arguments, and continue to see, you know, that both sides butting heads on that, on those specific points.
But what evidence do they have that buying these two companies stifled the competition, and that this was a bad deal for consumers?
Yeah, totally. Well, you get to the real key point of antitrust actions, which focuses on how does this, how is this bad for the consumer, right? And I think Facebook's argument is generally that, look, all of our stuff is free. We did not create sort of new paid products as a result of these acquisitions, and people are free to sort of use it or not use it at any time. And also that, you know, part of this is that you can't sort of go back in time and presume to know what Instagram or WhatsApp would have been without Facebook. And Facebook argues that they wouldn't have been as big as they have grown to now without Facebook's help. But I think the proponents of a breakup kind of just focus on the idea that, look, if all you need to sort of prove the case is that Facebook acted with sort of express intent to snuff out any sort of competition when they were doing the M&A at mergers and acquisitions at the time. And some of the evidence they have in the complaints specifically points to some of Mark Zuckerberg's language about essentially saying, you know, the thing about startups that concern us is that we can always buy them up. So I think they're going to focus on a lot of internal emails, things that, while they may not be a complete slam dunk, they certainly don't sound good with regards to how Zuckerberg views competition. So, and who knows what other sort of discovery will come out in the process.
So this is going to be a really long process. I can just see it, right? I mean,
yes.
It's years and years and years.
Oh my gosh. Definitely a couple of years. I mean, it depends on if they settle, but I'm gearing up for a couple of years, at least 2 or 3 years of a fight.
Oh, and meanwhile, there are also lawsuits against, or government action against, other companies like Google and Amazon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's supposedly, I think we're following a coming action on Google in the weeks or months ahead. Not exactly sure on the timing there. And yes, there's sort of inquiries in the Department of Justice. There are a bunch of different organizations in the federal government that sort of carry these actions out. So there's a lot of sort of concurrent investigations, whether it lives in the DOJ or the FTC. So it's not like the other companies are out of the woods quite yet.
Right. I mean, it's unquestionable that these are massive companies, but I guess when you get down to the nitty gritty, to exactly the legal arguments, it's much more difficult to kind of prove that that is a bad thing. Although I think we all viscerally feel like it's not a good thing to have so much market power, especially when you look at something like Google or Amazon in one company. But why is it so difficult to untangle that in the first place?
No, totally. I think it really goes back to the key point of, and this is something that antitrust scholars sort of bring up, which is, you know, the burden is to prove that this is bad for the consumer, and perhaps antitrust laws need some revision in how they're sort of enforced, or what the sort of standards are for enforcing them. I still think there are cases to be made around how they can be bad for the consumer, but it's not as clear cut as one might think, other than just the sort of nebulous feeling you pointed to that, wow, maybe they're too big.
Yeah. All right. Mike Isaac, tech correspondent for The New York Times. Thanks.
Thank you.
Coming up, why are monoliths popping up? We'll talk to the creators of one near San Luis Obispo.
We put it up there as like a fun thing. A piece of guerrilla artwork, and we were going to pull it down within, like, by the weekend.
That's coming up next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, over the weekend, a monolith sprung up in Santa Clarita Valley, one of a few sightings of monoliths over the past few weeks. The first was found in a remote part of the Utah desert. A monolith appeared in mid-November. Then, days later, it disappeared. They've since been spotted in Romania and in England and in Atascadero, California. We don't know who's putting most of these monoliths up, except for the ones in Atascadero. Two artists, two of the three, are joining me now, Travis Kenny and Wade McKenzie. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
So why did you want to put a monolith up in Atascadero?
This is Travis. Me and Wade go to lunch almost daily. We're like brothers, small town. We went to lunch, but December 1st, we'd been discussing the Utah one, how it brought a lot of people out hiking and hanging out. And we're like, wow, you know, that's kind of bitching. And then we saw it disappear, and then the second one popped up. And, you know, being a little bit of a space geeks, we kind of understood the where it was going with the Space Odyssey. And we're like, hey, you know what? We need to get the third one out. So we, at 3 o'clock, we started building it, and had it up there about, what, 11:30?
Just about midnight.
Yeah. Midnight, we had it done.
Wait, that same day you had lunch? You just started building a monolith and had it done the same day?
Yeah.
Wow. How did you do that?
I'm Wade. I called in a lot of favors to get me some parts made, you know, around the area. And we designed it at lunch and made some phone calls at lunch and had some parts cut and sent over to the shop. And we started welding with Travis's dad. End of the night, we called Jared to come down. Because we're all avid hikers and runners and bike mountain bikers. I mean, not to boast, but we're pretty good shape for 50 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Travis is a little younger, but we'll carry this thing up the mountain tonight and have it done.
How much does it weigh, or did it weigh?
I think the first one weighed probably around 200 and some pounds.
Oh, my gosh.
All stainless steel.
And did you model it on the Kubrick monolith from the movie?
No, we did not.
We liked the triangle image that was done out in Utah, and you know, mm-hmm. the other one became that same kind of design, and so we kind of went with that.
Uh-huh.
This is me and Wade again butting in. It's like we put it up there as like a fun thing, a piece of guerrilla artwork, and we were going to pull it down within like by the weekend, and if not, maybe a group of kids will take it and steal it and put it in their frat house or something. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, someone did take it.
Yeah, someone did take
it.
Well, they took it the wrong way. They made it political. They made it racist. They made it. They did it in such a horrific way that we're like, you know what? That's not right. Our town's a small town. Everybody was having a good time with it. They were getting out and about.
They were loving mm-hmm. it.
People that you know probably don't usually hike were out there. And then the day it got taken and then the video popped up, we still went out there and there's still people from L.A., San Francisco driving to come see where it was.
We met that lady and her son from Santa Barbara and they're on their way and heard that it was missing. And they still went up there anyway. There were still people going up to the spot where it's not. I started calling it for
Right. And so the people who took it, they made some racist remarks about being anti-alien, either from south of the border or from outer space, right? I mean, that was their message.
Tearing it down the name of some religion, too, is like, when we went up there, we noticed this before this even happened. Travis and I were talking about, there was no politics. There was no talk about illness, right? There was no illness on the mountain. It was just all people walking up there and like having a great time. And then it went viral by that afternoon. Maybe subconsciously, we wanted to unite people. That's what the third monolith in the movie basically is about.
Yeah. Well, you made another one, right?
Yeah. So what we did is after it got taken down, we decided that we weren't going to let it bring us down. A lot of local people guessed that it was us. We went and talked to a local person and asked what we should do with the next one. And they said, put it on top of the hill and make sure it doesn't leave. So we built a same identical one, but with a substructure that was engineered at Wade's got a metal engineer fabrication shop, and we called in a lot more favors. We made it a lot stronger. We packed it up the hill because it was twice as heavy.
We brought in about a 5-time bigger crew the next day.
We carried 700 pounds of concrete and stuck it in the ground this time.
Wow. So it's not going anywhere.
Well, that's not,
not a challenge.
It's not a challenge.
But I mean, it's not going anywhere.
So what's the scene now? Are people coming back to see it?
Yeah, the mountain busy as can be. This whole project is kind of morphed, and it just keeps morphing and morphing, which is interesting to us. We're figuring out ways to try to get, for this to benefit our town. You know, this is always mm-hmm. about our town.
Mm-hmm. We're going to have to benefit this trail now. Within a few weeks, this thing will be
beat up.
Need some help. So
we got the website, californiamonoliths.com. We're going to do a virtual 5K, a virtual 10K. A portion of the proceeds we're going to send out to our trail maintenance crews. We've got a lot of hiking up here. We've got a lot of people that love hiking and mountain biking and a lot of trails that need some love. So we're going to start doing some stuff that we can use the funds to maintain our trails.
Yeah. Well, so it is a positive story in the end. You had a setback, but there's a happy ending.
Like we said, end of the year is perseverance, right? We're all going to get through it.
Yep.
One way or another.
Yeah, I mean, there's something really comforting, even though it can be viewed as sinister, but the way that you're portraying it, there's something comforting about a monolith. It's like sturdy, and
that's what I want to know too. Is like the question to even how is it malevolent?
I don't know. I mean, because it appears out of nowhere, people might think, "Oh, aliens."
Wow, something good. How can something good can't appear out of nowhere? You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's why we wanted to back up again. I mean, like, people loved it. Like, I'm not even kidding. Like, when I say this, it warmed my heart. Like, to see people go up there and go, not talk about politics, not talk about stuff, but just to, like, they were calm.
Yeah.
I mean, it was all makes, races, sizes of people. I mean, there was a lady up there that it's a hard 2-mile trail. It's not the easiest trail in the world to hike. And one lady's like, I'm going to take 2 hours to get up there, but I'm getting my ass up there. We've heard people that, like, hey, I haven't been hiking in years, and this is going to get me back out. So the positive aspect that's came out of this is really, it's bitching.
I also like that you've brought the word bitching back. So that's a positive, too.
Where did it go?
I don't know. Where did it go?
Now we're dating me, aren't we?
Well, Happy New Year, I guess.
Yeah, Happy New Year to you, and get on our website this week and join our 5K hike or run, whatever you want to do. Get outside and hike.
Cool. All right. Well, I want to thank you both so much for coming on the show today, and thanks for building the monolith.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Wade McKenzie and Travis Kenny, they built the monolith that's in Atascadero. Coming up, drag performer Taylor Mack is back with a unique take on the holidays. Our conversation is next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. This has been a year like no other, so why not a holiday performance like no other this year? I present to you playwright, drag performer, and singing historian Taylor Mack. A couple of years ago, Taylor Mack took over the theater at the Ace Hotel to present 4 nights of uninterrupted 6-hour performances to tell the entire history of the United States in song. Well, now Taylor Mack is back performing for one night only on Saturday in a show called Holiday Sauce Pandemic. And because it is a Taylor Mack show, it features a character named Sexual Consent Santa and a burlesque baby Jesus. Taylor Mack began performing this show 3 years ago in New York. Now songs featured in it are on a new album titled Holiday Sauce. As for the live show, well, like everything else this year, it's gone virtual. Taylor Mack joins me now. Welcome back.
Hello, it's nice to be here.
Well, it's nice to have you. Tell us, if you can, what the show is about.
Oh, yeah. Well, I've always disliked the December. It's a rough month. But my drag mother, Mother Flawless Sabrina, she said to me, Taylor, you are the boss. You're the boss applesauce, is what she would say to all her drag minions. And what she meant is that we're in charge of our own lives. So if you don't like something, change it. So I said, oh, well, why don't I make a show that I do every year? I'll gather all my chosen family with me. We'll get to hang out and be as queer as we possibly can. again on the holiday season. And it's a bit of a variety show. Everywhere we go, we pick up local performers. And this year we've gathered all of the ones that we performed with, and we're squishing them all in with little cameos. And we're calling it a virtual vaudeville. And it's just a blast. We have such a good time. And it's really changed my feeling about December, the entire month.
So now you like December. It's a good month for you.
I do. I look forward to it now because I get together with all my friends. And even in COVID time, we've been able to get together in different ways with each other and work to make a show, because we're not film people, but we've made this gorgeous, all this gorgeous pre-recorded material. I'm so excited about it. And everyone's gotten to stretch in different ways. And so there's been some positive stuff to it, even though I long to be with people again.
Yeah. Well, speaking of longing to be with people, your shows usually feature the audience. Like you don't just perform to the audience, you involve the audience. I mean, I remember in the show I just mentioned at the Theater of the Ace Hotel, it was really quite a festival of audience participation. You bring people up on stage, everyone was up and meeting each other. And, you know, there's all of this connection happening. And how are you going to do that this time around without a live audience?
Well, I mean, well, this is a great opportunity for people who are terrified of audience participation to see us, because I'm not going to get in your lap, honey, you know, but I've reframed it in my mind. And what I've decided is the audience is Santa Claus and our show is the milk and the cookies, right? So you don't expect Santa Claus to participate other than show up and do his job and leave and maybe nibble on some milk and cookies, right? And you don't expect Santa to applaud you. You don't expect Santa to laugh at your jokes, right? But you put the milk and cookies out as a thank you to all the work that they've been doing. So I just kind of think, we're the milk and cookies. If it's exciting for you to have some milk and cookies this year, then come join us.
Well, okay. Let's talk about your costumes, because those are really, may I say, dazzling. And your costume designer is named Machine Dazzle. And let me just describe one from a previous performance. You are wearing a giant, shiny green Medusa headdress. And you have a shiny green hog with an apple in its mouth wrapped around your shoulders like a shrug. Can you describe one of your favorite costumes from Holiday Sauce?
Oh, well, there's so many good ones. The one that, well, I'll describe this one because we're not wearing it in the show. It's almost like a Ziegfeld Follies feather extravaganza, but it's the Winter Wonderland is what we call it. And there's this owl made out of sparkly material that's just around my chest. And there's woodland creatures in the wig. It's all white and sparkly and just gorgeous. It's really divine. And I'm wearing a couple different outfits in this show, and Machine is making me a brand new one. I don't see them until the day that I try them on for the show. Sometimes a minute before I go on stage. So that's the way we like to work with each other, because I like to work spontaneously with whatever Machine gives me and just embrace it. So it's always a blast. It's always a surprise for me, just as much as it is for the audience.
And as I said, you have a new album out with songs from the show. And I just want to play a little bit from the album. And let's listen to a track. It's a cover of Frank Ocean's Super Rich Kids. So let's hear a little bit of that.
Too many bottles of this rum I can't pronounce. Too many bowls of that cream, no look at Jones. The maids come around too much. Parents ain't around enough. Too many joyrides and daddy's Jaguar. Too many white lies and white lies.
A great song, but not really a holiday song per se.
Well, I think of it as a holiday song. Well, one of the reasons I've always disliked the holidays is because of the onslaught of capitalism, and it never seemed like the spirit of giving. So a song that's about people that have too much in their life and maybe kind of abuse that privilege is an opportunity to consider things during the holiday time. And it's just also a great song to sing and yeah. fun to exist inside of. So anything that's celebratory and contemplative, I think is in the holiday spirit, because isn't that what the holiday is about? It's like, let's get together, let's consider what it means to be in ritual and in family, and also in society as well. And let's celebrate as well as contemplate.
So the previous show that took place at the theater at the Ace Hotel, The History of America as Told Through Song, basically, you are giving a history lesson, albeit a really fun one and a really entertaining one. But you do have a message in your shows that is serious. And it seems like from what you've just said about Frank Ocean's song, you have a message in this show as well.
I mean, I always say it's the audience's job to find the profundity. You know, I'm more like a diviner. So I got my little divining stick and it starts to shake and I go, I think the profundity might be right here. And then I'd say to the audience, okay, get digging. So it's your job to decide whether or not the Frank Ocean song is deep or just a fun beat. You know, and I present it the way that I present it, but hopefully the audience, we inspire the audience to dig a little bit. that makes me happy when I see the audience going deeper into their considerations. You know, the big question I'm always asking on a stage is, how do we live a virtuous life in an unvirtuous world? I don't have the answer to the question, but I think it's an interesting one to pass around amongst the collaborative, and that includes the audience.
You see the world as unvirtuous?
I see it as pretty unvirtuous, yeah. I mean, not necessarily naturally so, but certainly when there's a pandemic and it becomes political to wear a mask. And then, you know, suddenly I'm like, I think we're living in an unvirtuous world. But so how do you adjust and live your most virtuous self in that experience? And that is a big question that philosophers and artists, musicians, everybody's been grappling with that for, their entire lives. I think that's the main conversation that everybody's having in obvious ways and subtle ways.
Well, in that vein, I want to play another clip of you performing a song. It's called Christmas with Grandma. And here you're singing about Christmas with Grandpa on your father's side.
My mother takes me there to counterbalance all the masculinity that was lost when my father died. And so Grandpa, he buys me a shotgun, even though I'm only 5 years old. And he gets really drunk and we go out and shoot things and scamper about. And the women, they stay inside and cook the meal. Except for my grandma on my father's side, who's not there because she died when my father was a child. And that's when Grandpa really hit the bottle, but he didn't want to drink alone, so he got his 13-year-old son to start drinking with him. And that's when Dad became an alcoholic. And then years later, he would crash into the oncoming traffic and leave my sister and my mom and I alone to have Christmas with Grandpa. This song is depressing.
Yeah, it is. although told with your characteristic verve and sense of humor, is that a true story?
I never make up anything. I just cut and paste sometimes. So something that maybe happened to a cousin, I might make happen to a sister. But I don't actually make anything up. You know, it's all true. Yeah.
And is that what happened to your dad?
Yeah, he died when my sister and I were kids, and he was drunk on a motorcycle. And
wow. And then you spent Christmas with Grandpa, and he tried to teach you how to shoot.
Yes. Yeah, he would get drunk, and we would go out and shoot things.
Wow. So,
it was an interesting childhood for a little queer kid, you know. And I can't say that. From my kid's perspective, it was kind of fun. You know, I can't say it was all bad. But as I grew older and I kind of understood that the dynamics were that the women always stayed inside and cooked the meal and the men went out and got drunk and the only thing they could talk about was sports and they killed things. And you start to realize the limitation of that as you get older. And and that's part of people's tradition. And so it makes them feel good. It makes them feel like that's family. So it's hard to ask somebody to dismantle that, the things that make them feel good. And the holiday season sometimes, though, isn't good for everybody. And that particular locked perspective on how to behave in the world is maybe not the best thing for a society. So the thing that we're trying to do with the show is navigate both the empathy and the celebration of other people while chiseling a place for ourselves, the people who are a little bit different and maybe don't want to exist in that same narrative. So yeah, that's our job.
So we talked about this at the beginning of the conversation where you said that you got inspiration from your drag mother.
Mother Flawless Sabrina.
Yeah. And so I'm wondering if this whole experience that you talked about in growing up with your grandpa and your dad dying in a motorcycle accident and being an alcoholic, if all that kind of gave you impetus later as you became an adult to choose your own family, and if that's where that came from, that you decided that it would be better to be in a chosen family than the family you were born into.
Well, I think it was years and years and years of censoring myself and feeling guilty when I don't participate in the family things and feeling like an outsider when I do participate in the family things. And it was years of meeting other kinds of people and creating bonds with them and realizing that sometimes chosen family can be a biological and sometimes it's not. And that is a wonderful thing, to find your own family in the world. And, you know, Mother Flawless Sabrina, she died right before we were creating the holiday show. And I thought, you know, I actually just want to make a show that's a celebration of Mother Flawless Sabrina. And I'll disguise it as a holiday show so that people will come. But really all we're doing is celebrating, in a lot of ways, mentorship and elders. But specifically Mother Flawless Sabrina, who had these drag pageants. In 1959, she had drag pageants all across the U.S. She had 100 full-time employees. You know, this is a remarkable queen. And she changed the perspective of so many young people and lifted us up and invited us into a different way of thinking. And I feel very liberated and thankful. My career is what it is because Mother Flawless Sabrina came around at the right time in my life and gave me the right kind of advice. So we've all had that kind of experience in our life, someone, or at least hopefully we're lucky enough to have someone that's lifted us up right at the time we needed it. And so that, I think, is worth hanging out in December and thinking about.
Well, let's end with how your album ends, with a little hope. And here's your cover of the Christian song, How Can I Keep From Singing?
Through all the tumult and the strife, I hear the music ringing. It sounds an echo.
That song. One of the lyrics is, you know, that it's dark out and it's cold and everything, but songs in the night happen as a result of all of that. There's troubling time, but hey, you get to sing a song, you know, and a song can be created because of the troubling time. And that's the great joy of my life, actually, is getting together with the band and singing, and other getting together with other people singing too. You know, it's a little challenging right now because we can't do that all together, but you know, it's coming to an end. It really is. It's like the most hope that we've had in a long time, actually. So, yeah.
Well, Taylor Mack, it has been a pleasure. Thank you for coming on the show again today.
Thank you so much, Madeline, for having me.
CAP UCLA presents Holiday Sauce Pandemic on Saturday, December 12th at 7 o'clock. And that's where you can see Taylor Mack performing. And if you want want to see some of Taylor Mack's dazzling costumes, check out our Instagram at KCW Press Play. And that'll do it for us today. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.
Tempest loudly roars. I hear the truth, it lives, and though the darkness round me close, songs in the night. It giveth, no storm can shake my inmost core, while to this rock I'm clinging, while love is on. Can I keep from singing? How can I keep from singing?
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.